The Today programme continues on FM, but here on 198 Longwave and on DAB Digital Radio, it's time for Yesterday in Parliament with me, Sean Curran. Good morning from Westminster. Coming up between now and nine, the Miller's tale dominates Prime Minister's questions. Complaints that changes to immigration policy have damaged British universities. And beans, beans, they're good for your heart. Beans, beans, they make you think about global warming. Listeners of a sensitive disposition should block their ears. There was a moment during yesterday's Prime Minister's questions when battle-hardened government MPs were shocked to discover that Ed Miliband was the man who
came here today determined to play politics in every single way that he could. Absolutely clear.
But it was hardly a surprise that the Labour leader chose to concentrate on the resignation of Maria Miller.
The events of the last week have caused deep concern and anger to the public. What lessons has the Prime Minister learnt from his handling of the situation?
Well, first of all, I agree with him. There is still very deep concern, public concern, that is still very raw about the expenses scandal.
But Mr Cameron also wanted to talk about a lesson he didn't want anyone to learn.
That the right thing to do as soon as someone has to answer allegations is just to instantly remove them rather than give them a chance to clear their name and get on with their job.
Ed Miliband!
Well, I was asking about his handling of the situation and the lessons he learnt, and he had no answer.
In the traditional exchange of resignation letters, the Prime Minister told his former Culture Secretary that it was important to be clear that the Committee on Standards had cleared her.
So can he now explain what, in his view, the Culture Secretary did wrong?
Well, the Culture Secretary has set out the reasons for her resignation in her letter, but he does make an important point, which is the Culture Secretary was accused of a very serious offence, which was, by a Member of Parliament, she was accused of housing her parents at the public expense. Now, she was cleared of that allegation, and I thought it was right. Other people will be able to take their own view. I'm telling you about my view. I thought it was right, in those circumstances, to allow her to make her apology and continue with her job.
Ed Miliband wondered why Maria Miller was no longer in her job if the Prime Minister thought she'd done nothing wrong.
She refused to cooperate with an inquiry, she breached the code of conduct for MPs, and she gave a perfunctory and inadequate apology to this House, as people on all sides have been saying. But he said 6 days ago she had done the right thing and we should leave it at that. Does he now recognise this was a terrible error of judgment?
David Cameron wanted to know why the Labour leader hadn't called on Mrs Miller to resign.
Right. He seems to be, in my view, the first leader of the opposition, probably in history, to come to this House and make the first suggestion that someone should resign after they've already resigned.
Mr Ed Miliband!
I've heard everything. It's my job to fire members of his cabinet.
He accused the Prime Minister of not understanding what Maria Miller had done wrong.
The reason the public was so appalled was that if it had happened in any other business, there would have been no question about them staying in their job.
David Cameron said the ex-Culture Secretary had apologised for doing some things wrong, but he thought Ed Miliband's attitude was extraordinary.
The right honourable gentleman now coming here, having not said she should resign, and saying she should have resigned. I think it shows all the signs of someone seeing a political bandwagon and wanting to jump on it. But he is jumping on this bandwagon after the whole circus has left town.
But he agreed that something needed to be done about expenses.
We should do everything we can to show that this is a good and honest parliament with good and hard-working people in it. That is the assumption that I start for, and I make no apology for that.
The Prime Minister describes it as a bandwagon and a circus. This is about the members of this country absolutely appalled by the conduct of his government over the last week. That is what it is about. It is about members of the public who cannot understand why he did not act.
And the Labour leader accused the Prime Minister of undermining trust in politics.
The Culture Secretary went not because of her bad conduct, but because of her bad press. Yeah. He promised in opposition to be an apostle for better standards, and he spent the last week being an apologist for unacceptable behaviour.
David Cameron went back to his original argument and said it wasn't leadership to fire someone at the first sign of trouble.
That is actually not leadership, that is weakness. And if that is his recommendation of leadership, I don't think the country will have any of it.
It was a noisy session, and at one point, the Commons Speaker, John Bercow, stepped in.
I happen to know there are children here today observing our proceedings who would like to think the House would show a good example. Let's see if we can.
There was some sniggering from MPs at that not in front of the children warning, but hopefully you got the message. Ed Miliband and David Cameron may be going through a rocky patch, but they still love you, the voters.
Mr. Tim Farron.
Speaker, would the Prime Minister agree with me?
A few MPs didn't groan when the Lib Dem President, Tim Farron, stood up, but the Speaker gave them another chance.
It shouldn't be a collective groan. No, it's not. The Honourable Gentleman is good-humoured. But order! The House will hear the Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Tim Farron.
That's much better. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
But there was an outbreak of goodwill when a Conservative, Jason McCartney, canvassed the Prime Minister's support ahead of the London Marathon. Mr. Cameron paid tribute to the MPs from all sides who'll be running the 26 miles to raise money for good causes.
Over the cornflakes this morning, I saw a very attractive picture of my honourable friend in his shorts and the Shadow Chancellor in a curious pair of black leggings.
It was a rare moment of good humour. Well, at least Ed Miliband, who was sitting next to Ed Balls, found it funny. The Commons begins its Easter break later today. A Conservative, David Nuttall, suggested Mr Cameron might like to read a prize-winning essay setting out how the UK could leave the European Union. But it sounded as though the PM had other plans.
Perhaps the novel of my honourable friend, the member for Mid-Bedfordshire. That is obviously another choice for this festive period.
The MP for Mid-Bedfordshire is Nadine Dorris, whose first novel has just been published. As the Prime Minister left the Commons, the Speaker was overheard making another suggestion.
If you want an intellectual and upmarket read, Chris Bryant's book on poetry.
Labour MP Chris Bryant has just published the first part of a two-volume history of Parliament. Unfortunately, the microphone didn't pick up the Prime Minister's reply. But perhaps given recent events, David Cameron is looking forward to some time away from Westminster. Well, over in the House of Lords, there were calls from all sides for ministers to rethink the government's policies on immigration. Peers complained foreign students were being put off from applying to British universities. One speaker said current visa restrictions were plain stupid. But a government spokesman insisted the UK was open to legitimate students. Viv Robbins reports.
Speakers in this five-hour debate range far and wide over many aspects of Britain's higher education system, but the topic which appeared to generate most heat was the tighter visa regime imposed on foreign students as part of government attempts to crack down on immigration abuse. The crossbench or independent peer Lord Billy Moria, himself a former foreign student in the UK, thought the country was now in danger of being seen as downright xenophobic.
My Lord, the situation is not good. For the first time ever, our total student numbers are down. In a rush to reduce net migration to tens of thousands by the next election, the government has succeeded in convincing some of the world's most talented young minds that Britain doesn't want them.
The Conservative peer Lord Holmes of Richmond, the Paralympic medalist Chris Holmes, thought the message should be quite the opposite, that Britain needed, wanted and welcomed international students from across the planet.
It's understandable that there's nervousness at the time when the economy wasn't in great shakes, but that is of no consequence or excuse. Whatever the economic backdrop, we need, want and welcome international students. Of course, we shouldn't be naive about the fake student, the conjured up course, the non-existent institution, but these are no reasons to clamp down and shut the door on all that possibility.
The Liberal Democrat peer Lady Sharp of Guildford, herself a former university lecturer, agreed.
I entirely endorse what has been said by the noble Lord, Lord Billamoria, about the sheer ludicrousy of the current policy in relation to international students. It is really rather absurd that we have two departments, the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills, which is doing its best to encourage international students to come here, while at the same time the Home Office does its best to discourage them. Quite stupid.
In a maiden speech, the Bishop of Portsmouth, the Right Reverend Christopher Foster, spoke of declining numbers of international students in his own city.
That reduced number, confirmed recently across the whole national HE sector, costs us all as we turn away the world's talents and ideas. That presence is vital, both in monetary and in human and educational terms. They enliven and enrich the whole community. Their flourishing matters to us all and needs to be safeguarded in our legislation.
The Labour peer and sociologist Lord Giddens, as Anthony Giddens, a former director of the London School of Economics, was one of several speakers who denounced the current system of student funding as unsustainable, following the recent revelation that 45% of students were not now expected to be able to repay their student loans. These problems, he said, were compounded by the government's policy on overseas student visas.
Attracting overseas students is not just a matter of generating revenue, although that revenue is in fact very large. It is again bound up with the public and cosmopolitan role of universities. In my own role as director of the LSE, I can attest firsthand to how important overseas students are in spreading British influence, ideals and culture around the world.
But Lord Ahmad of Wimbledon, representing the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills, insisted the government was fully committed to international students.
International students, just to be clear, are not capped. Their numbers are not capped. And I can do nothing better than quote my right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, when he visited India last year, when he said, "We are open for anyone wishing to come to the UK for a legitimate course at an accredited university. The doors are open."
But Lord Ahmad added that he would give careful thought to the points raised in the debate, no mean undertaking given that, in all, no fewer than 29 peers had taken part.
Viv Robbins reporting. You're listening to Yesterday in Parliament on BBC Radio 4 Longwave and on DAB Digital Radio with me, Sean Curran. Still to come this morning...
The noble lord's question is so... different.
And we'll find out what the question was and why it was so different a bit later in the programme. But before that, it's not often a politician gets the chance to let off a bit of steam.
What we had is a mischievous, disingenuous, mealy-mouthed, patronising, lefty drivel of a speech.
That was the Conservative Stuart Jackson, and he didn't stop there.
The typical middle-class, tofu-munching, Guardian-reading Labour nonsense.
And what had got him so upset? Well, MPs had been discussing plans to bring in a tax break for married couples from next year, during a debate on the bill that puts much of the budget into law. Under the proposal, a person would be allowed to transfer part of their personal tax allowance to their partner, just so long as that partner earned less than £10,500 a year. Mr Jackson likes the idea, and he wasn't at all impressed when the Labour Shadow Treasury Minister, Catherine McKinnell, dismissed the policy as a dud that wouldn't help two out of three married couples or people in a civil partnership.
A scenario described by Don't Judge My Family campaign as a fantasy 1950s family with a breadwinner and homemaker.
She argued that the money could be better used to support families.
Five in six of the UK's families with children will not get a penny from this government's flagship policy to support them. And indeed, it does absolutely nothing for widows and widowers, for lone parents. It does nothing for long-term cohabiting couples, for the 300,000 children living with grandparents or kinship carers, or for the spouse who has left their partner for good reason, perhaps domestic abuse.
But the policy won strong backing from a Conservative, Sir Edward Lee, who said it was common practice around the world.
This is not some way out, wacky idea from the Christian right. This is what most countries do. The fact is that of the most of the biggest countries in the OECD, it's only the UK, Mexico and Turkey which don't have a transferable allowance.
And another Conservative, the former Education Minister Tim Lawton, who'd campaigned for the tax change, wanted ministers to extend it to more married couples.
Particularly concentrating on those with children and particularly those under the age of five, where this can have the greatest impact and where we need to give the greatest stability to those young children in their most formative and impressionable years.
But Labour's Alison Seebeck continued to oppose the idea.
It is a measure which, like a lot of measures brought forward by this government, is disingenuous at best, but it came forward with a fanfare of trumpets after a great deal of pressure from backbenchers opposite. But it's basically unfair.
But a Labour call for a review of the impact of the tax relief was rejected by 59 votes. Now, a former head of the police force in Northern Ireland has denied that Downing Street put pressure on the police to release Republican suspects. Sir Hugh Orde was giving evidence to MPs on the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee who are investigating so-called on-the-runs. Here's Peter Mulligan.
MPs are trying to get to the bottom of why letters were sent to around 200 Republicans stating that they weren't wanted by police. The letters came to light when the trial of John Downey, who denied charges relating to the IRA's Hyde Park bombing, was halted because he'd mistakenly received one of the letters. MPs asked the view of the former head of the police in Northern Ireland, Sir Hugh Orde.
My understanding of his scheme, referred to as the administrative scheme, was that it was categorically not and never was planned to be an amnesty. It was simply a notification that the subject was not wanted at that time, and new evidence, of course, was always a possibility.
He described the police involvement in gathering evidence for such letters.
Well, we had a very limited and restricted role, which in the most simple of terms was we would receive a list of names from the Northern Ireland office. We would look at those names to form a view on whether they were wanted or not, i.e. if they came into jurisdiction, would they be arrested and interviewed, or would they be arrested and charged, or simply charged, or in some cases returned to prison. Having carried out that analysis, we then sent that to the prosecuting authority, and that is where our role ended.
MPs turned to suggestions of political pressure. Last week, a retired Detective Chief Superintendent, Norman Baxter, told them that Downing Street had attempted to pervert the course of justice by asking for Republican suspects to be released in 2007. That never happened, Sir Hugh said, in his term of office. Not by Downing Street and...
At no time did any Secretary of State, and I had four of those, try to influence me, and at no time did any official from the Northern Ireland office ever try to influence my operational decision-making. And had they, I would have made it public immediately.
But MPs dug away at the idea that there'd been political interference aimed at smoothing the path to peace, including the independent unionist, Lady Sylvia Herman.
Can I ask you frankly, was a blind eye turned to what was the end product after the initial police assessment?
That's an interesting question, but it's not one that it's right for me to sort of explain. My role was clear. We had a job to do, and I take full responsibility for allowing that process to take place within the PSNI to the point it was. We shared that information with the law officers quite properly. What happened post that event is for others to explain.
Did you not care? Sorry,
of course I cared. All I cared about was delivering an effective policing service and building confidence across two communities, and that was a challenge of equal measure. But to try and suggest that I should then start engaging in political engineering about what was then done by very senior law officials with that information, I think is simply unreasonable and unfair.
Lady Herman wasn't happy with that.
How exactly has it built confidence in Northern Ireland with those two communities, particularly the lawyers' community, when they have discovered now, post-Downey, that a secret invisible scheme was being assisted by the PSNI. How does that impact on the loyalist community?
Sir Hugh said it was difficult to please everybody.
This was very complicated. There are, frankly, no winners in this. There are lots of victims who will be upset and outraged at the decisions government made on the back of that, some of that information. That's for them to describe, not me.
When he suggested people who'd received the letter would be arrested if new evidence emerged, the Democratic Unionist Ian Paisley returned to the case of John Downey.
There is new evidence. There's fingerprint evidence about other activities. They've arrested him and he's out scot-free. That's why there's such anger about it. Hugh, you know that.
Well, I understand
it's not
the process
plausible
here.
What you're saying.
Sir Hugh took issue with that.
I'm afraid it's what happened, Ian. It's a fact. We did what we were asked to do entirely properly, entirely lawfully. Your questions about what people did with that information, you need to get in front of this so you can ask them the questions, not infer that I was playing some clever game around a very delicate process, a very delicate peace process, of which this was just one bit.
The MPs went on to take evidence from a former Labour Northern Ireland Secretary, Sean Woodward. He said the letters had not been immunities from prosecution. The process had been sensitive, he said, but not secret. It had been discussed in public and in the media at the time.
Peter Mulligan reporting. More details about people who die in incidents involving cattle need to be recorded in a bid to prevent future deaths, according to a Conservative MP. Bill Wiggin, who breeds Hereford cattle himself, told the Commons that people going for walks in the countryside, as well as agricultural workers, were potentially at risk.
There is a case ongoing in our courts at the moment, resulting from a rambler being found dead. Over the past 4 years, 24 people have been killed in incidents with cattle. More than 600 people a year are injured. Mr. Speaker, I'm sure we all feel that too many people are dying in livestock-related incidents, and we should be doing more to stop this problem.
He said the Health and Safety Executive should record the age and type of livestock involved, whether the incident was near a right-of-way, and other useful information.
The Wildlife and Countryside Act of 1981 lists 7 breeds of dairy bull that are prohibited at all times from fields with public footpaths. Breed information, which is easy to access from cattle passports, is not automatically recorded, and it must be.
The MP was allowed to bring in a bill to make the changes he wants, but a lack of parliamentary time and government support means the legislation won't make further progress. Now, you've probably heard of Japanese knotweed, said to be one of the world's worst invasive species. The plant is capable of bursting through concrete and brickwork. But would you recognise it? Lady Sharples, a Conservative, thinks there needs to be a publicity campaign aimed at landowners.
And even more important, by people seeking to buy a house with land, because in some cases they're being refused a mortgage.
Now, their lordships have often discussed the menace of Japanese knotweed, and Lady Sharples has often been at the forefront of those discussions, as the Environment Minister, Lord De Morley, recognised.
My Lords, in returning regularly to this question, my noble friend is almost as persistent as the weed itself. I'm not sure whether she's a hardy annual or a perennial.
He agreed about the need for public awareness. And as for mortgages...
2 years ago, the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors and the Council of Mortgage Lenders agreed a less draconian approach was needed.
A more draconian approach was needed towards those who didn't tackle the weed, said the Liberal Democrat, Lord Greaves.
Is it not the case that the time has come when allowing this invasive alien weed to grow on your land should be an offence?
The minister didn't agree.
I think it would be disproportionate and possibly unfair to impose very strong conditions on landowners, apart from anything else, because this weed can arrive on their land through no fault of their own. What I can say, though, is that farmers receiving single farm payment are required to take reasonable steps to prevent its spread.
Lord Greaves had accused the government of making no progress on getting rid of Japanese knotweed. Lord De Morley said the aim was to manage it, not eradicate it. And he updated peers on the release of a sap-sucking insect to help stop the spread of the weed. The trial is taking place in England and Wales.
My Lords, we're in the fourth year of the controlled release of the psyllid Aphalara itadori as a means of controlling Japanese knotweed. No non-target impacts have been observed by the monitoring programme, but as yet the organism has had difficulty establishing self-sustaining populations. This year, therefore, we will conduct caged trials, releasing larger numbers to establish higher population densities.
But the Labour spokesman, Lord Davis of Oldham, said the minister needed to demonstrate a real sense of urgency on the issue.
There's been a recent survey which says there is not 6 miles of square land in this country which is not infected with this this weed. It's in Swansea, they've calculated they've got 62,000 tonnes of it to get rid of. Now, my lords, it's clear this is a major problem. The effect upon network rail and the railway system is absolutely dramatic.
Lord de Morley said Lord Davis was right about the effects of Japanese knotweed, and he was sorry if the peer didn't think the government had appreciated the urgency of the situation. Another Labour member, Lord Dubbs, suggested more pressure could be put on local councils.
Could we not have some action for those people who've got knotweed in their neighbours' houses? I haven't got any in mind, but the neighbours have. And could we at least persuade local authorities, without legislation, to be more cooperative with local people? In my local authority, they're not willing to cooperate at all. They will give me no information. They're quite unhelpful. I know some are better than this. So how about leaning on the local authorities?
Lord de Morley said new community protection notices brought in under the Anti-Social Behaviour, Crime and Policing Act were potentially useful in this regard, and the government would look carefully at them. Now, there was a bit of schoolboy humour on display in the Lords when peers turned their attention to climate change. A Labour member, Lord Simon, raised the possible effect on the environment of eating too many baked beans.
In a programme some months ago on the BBC, it was stated that this country has the largest production of baked beans and the largest consumption of baked beans in the world. Could the noble baroness say whether this leads to the calculation of global warming by the government as a result of the emission, the smelly emission resulting therefrom?
Lord Simon is one of the small band of hereditaries left in the Lords. His grandfather, Sir John Simon, a Liberal, was given a peerage in 1940 after serving as Home Secretary, Foreign Secretary and Chancellor. It's probably safe to say that Sir John never spoke in the House about smelly emissions. And his grandson's question rather stumped the Minister, Lady Verma, at least at first.
The noble Lord's question is so different. My lords, I think what my noble lord friend, the noble lord, actually does raise a very important point, and that is, of course, that we do need to moderate our behaviour.
Well, peers have the wind in their sails because the House of Lords has already started its Easter break, but MPs have still one more day to go. So what are they getting up to today? Well, there'll be questions to Vince Cable and his team at the Department for Business, and the Leader of the House, Andrew Lansley, will set out what the Commons will be doing after the recess. There's a short debate on a committee inquiry into police recorded crime statistics, which found strong evidence that the police under-record crime, particularly sexual crimes such as rape, in many areas. Then MPs can raise just about any subject they like during the traditional pre-recess debate. You've been listening to Yesterday in Parliament with me, Sean Curran. The editor was Rachel Byrne. We'll be back at the usual time tomorrow. Till then, from me, good morning.